that's how the golf club moves. We put a force into the club and the mass, the golf club, accelerates. And that's a three variable equation. And you know what golf is. Competitive golf is a 660 variable equation.
This is the Tournament Code.
We appreciate you taking the time to join us, Mike. As usual, we have our Putview Books, our awesome sponsor, opening tee shot. And we like to do this kind of as an icebreaker. Sometimes I make the question too hard. Sometimes I make the question too easy. So I'm still working on how to get the question right. And I'll try to keep it kind of on topic, but or at least kind of in the realm of the category where our guests might know. I don't think this one is too absurd. And I think at least two of the answers are obvious. So we'll give it a shot. So don't feel bad if you get this one wrong. Opening shot. How many golfers have won at least 10 majors in their career?
Wow. That's a good one.
And you can name their names.
Yeah. So Nicklaus and Woods, mm-hmm. For sure. Jeez. I don't think Player got to double digits. Nicklaus Woods, Walter Hagen.
Boom. There you go. Very nice. Okay. All right. Three.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Whew. That is impressive. I don't know if I, Cooper, would you have pulled that one off?
I knew it was probably three, but I probably wouldn't have guessed the third correctly.
I wouldn't have guessed Hagen either.
Hey, I got one.
That's what I like to hear. Well, that's a great opening tee shot. Kind of tell us about what you're up to right now with your instruction. We've heard you talk some, but I think for our listeners, it'd be good to hear what you're up to right now and what things look like.
Sure. Well, my name's Mike Finney. I'm the director of instruction at the University of Louisville Golf Club. And really, I'm as traditional of a golf teacher as you can be. I teach on the member side of the driving range there, which is a great practice area at ULGC. And I take all comers. I take beginners all the way through, you know, guys wanting to play for a living. So I'm about as traditional as you can get. You just contact me, you know, through the phone, schedule a lesson. I do, you know, lessons by half hour, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever the student wants. So I'm not like, you know, I'm not in a kind of a factory. I'm not trying to sell packages and all that yet. I have somebody approach me. They want to get golf lessons and I give them a golf lesson. So it's a pretty traditional mode as far as that. And then as far as the instruction, I let the student drive that too. You know, if they want to work on full swing, we'll work on full swing, short game, want to get on the golf course and do some, you know, golf course strategy type things. And yeah, I can do pretty much any of those things for my students.
What is your kind of, this is a broad question, maybe a hard one to answer. If you had to put yourself maybe not in a mold, but kind of a direction as an instructor, what would you say maybe your philosophy is? We look at guys and they kind of range across the spectrum. There are some guys that we'd consider that people would consider old school and they themselves would consider them old school. I've heard some people say, oh, that's too much technology for an old guy like me to figure out. I can't deal with that. I just go by what people might call feel or go with maybe their eyeballs and maybe a camera. And then other people use technology more. And then and within that realm, also there's people that are focused on different things when it comes to technology. Like some guys are not swing your swing, but some guys seems like they try to fit their players all into one mold. At other times, it seems like they're adapting players around different things, like the shallow it out movement, I would call it. Right. For a while there are certain instructors that it seemed like all the only thing they were teaching, maybe I'm misrepresenting it, only thing they were teaching was specifically how to shallow it out, and everyone needs to shallow it out the exact same way. And not that shallowing isn't a good thing or can't be optimal. But now that I've blabbered on, tell me a little bit about where you stand on your philosophy.
That's a great question. I'm definitely not one of the guys that forces anybody into a model swing or a pattern. And I've seen people and groups of teachers do that, unfortunately. But I use a TrackMan. There's a lot of ways. If you're trying to hit a dead straight shot, there's a lot of ways to get to zero path and zero face, actually trillions of ways to get there. So I don't force any golf club to do any specific thing. Obviously, I'm not stupid. I can look at what successful golf swings look like and say, hey, you know, that's a pretty good little trend there. You got a group of guys hitting it pretty good and girls hitting it pretty good doing something like this. Maybe we can move a little bit toward this, but there's no hard and fast positions that the body or the golf club needs to get into that would satisfy me as a teacher. I'm trying to help the person in front of me make the ball go to where they want it to go and kind of shape it in the way that they wanted to get there. So I guess I'm a little bit of a blend of old school and new school in that respect. I use TrackMan every day for pretty much every lesson. But other than that, I study all the other stuff, you know, how the body moves, how the feet, you know, work into the ground and all that stuff. I study it and I study it really, really hard, but I just use that, all of that as background to get the student to be able to make the ball do what it wants to do, and by that, making TrackMan numbers look legitimate and the numbers that I know that they need to make them happy. So anyway, I don't know if I answered your question there, but yeah, that's kind of how I go about doing it.
That is perfect. When it comes to working with players in that regard, you said you study the data, you have gone deep into it. I know you have some, I don't know if course is the right word, is it some paid videos that people watch to learn more, to learn more and gain more from your studying. Tell and I also know that you kind of, if maybe this is not the right way, but you run with a select crew of a bunch of smart people that we all respect as far as working on understanding biomechanics, other things of that nature. Tell us a little bit about maybe what you've learned in that regard from what you've looked at in biomechanics, what you've looked at, and we'll start broad and then we can dive down deeper into some of the practicalities of it.
Sure. So yes, I was exposed to the golfing machine as a young golfer, actually. And and I don't know if the people listening to this podcast are familiar with the golfing machine or not, but it was sort of a quasi scientific approach to the golf swing and how to have the golf swing taught. So maybe I first heard of it in 81 or 2. 1981 or two, that's how old I am. And then went through 2005. So 25 years of, you know, kind of being a golfing machine proponent and saying, hey, you know, all the answers are in here. And then right around that time, my buddy Brian Manzella and I we were starting to figure out that the golfing machine was flawed in a lot of ways. And wow, we could have multiple podcasts about that and how it influenced Mac O'Grady and how Mac O'Grady influenced Andy Plummer and Mike Bennett of Stack and Tilt and how all of that stuff has kind of filtered through golf instruction. But I don't want to dwell on that. I'd rather like 2007, 8, 9, my buddy who's a golf instructor in Shelbyville, John Hardesty and I, John came to work for me at the Owl Creek Country Club. And he said, Mike, you know, there's golf swing research out there that we can learn from. And I'm like, there's nobody out there researching the golf swing, like at the PhD level or in academics. And he's like, no, it's out there. And he was right. And we found a guy named Stephen Nesbitt, who was a mechanical engineer in Lafayette College up in Pennsylvania. And after meeting or kind of talking to Stephen Nesbitt and seeing the papers that he wrote, everybody has a, you know, an addend, not an addendum, but a index at the end of their papers. And they just list papers that they referenced. And we started reaching out to authors of other papers. And one of the guys that was showing up was a young guy named Sasha McKenzie, who you guys may know of, who's a PhD in biomechanics up in Nova Scotia, Canada. And he and I have become really good friends. And he invented the stack, the club head swing speed system, and helped Matthew Fitzpatrick, you know, build his swing speed. And through my relationship with Sasha and, you know, several other researchers, I've been exposed to really good, scientifically solid ideas about the golf swing, where we're just not guessing and giving out jargon. Golf machine did for things. He actually uses scientific words that have meaning. And I've really based my understanding of the golf swing on the stuff that Sasho has showed me, and multiple other researchers have researched the golf swing, and I've learned from them. And I try to distill it down to the person that I'm giving a golf lesson to. I'm not out there quoting research papers on the lesson tee by a long stretch, but I do use that as beat background for my instruction program. And so if I had to point to one person, Sasha McKenzie would be that person. And Sasha has become friends and basically mentors to a lot of golf instructors that you guys know of that are doing really well now. Mark Blackburn and Chris Como would be two of them. John Sinclair, Joe Mayo, et cetera, et cetera. These guys go to Sasho and go to guys like Sasho when they have tough questions. And Frederick Tuckson would be another guy who the guy that invented TrackMan would be another guy that I've become friends with that I can bounce ideas off of. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So that's been since 2008. So we've got about 16 years of that under our belt. And whenever there's a research paper that comes out that might be applicable to something that I would need, I read it and read it again and read it again and try to understand it and then try to take a piece of it to the lesson tee for my students.
What do you think, or being somebody that's been in the game your whole life, what do you think made you be so open to these new ideas and these new people who may not have been in the game as long as you have?
Yeah, so I mean, we're talking about this in a lot of different levels. I mean, my relationship with Sasha McKenzie and other researchers is one thing, and then just my relationship with other instructors like Larry Ward and Brian Manzella and John Hardesty and guys like that's a whole nother thing. But I don't I was really kind of lost in the weeds when I was a golfing machine. I was an authorized instructor of the golfing machine, and I helped people. I think I did help people when I was trying to use the principles that the book set forward, but I know I didn't help as many as I could have. And so I just felt like, and Brian Manzella helped me with this. I mean, again, this is like 2006, 7, 8. He's like, hey, maybe we need to look further into this stuff. And you can't, there's an equation in physics. It's force equals mass times acceleration, F equals ma. And it's such a simple equation. And that's how the golf club moves. We put a force into the club, and the mass, the golf club, accelerates. And that's a three variable equation. And you know what golf is. Competitive golf is a 660 variable equation. What did you eat for breakfast? How did you feel on the 10th tee? Were you tired? I mean, it's just like, I mean, you go from physics, which is, complicated, but it's simple at its basic level. And what moves the club? And then you got the scorecard, and it's so complex what goes into the final number on the scorecard. And just trying to blend those two ends of the spectrum is sort of what I do. I mean, it's like I've got to use basic principles that apply every single day that never change to get an ever-changing score to change at the end of at the end of the day. And boy, the stuff in between all that is just mind-boggling. And I think that's kind of part of what we're going to talk about today, how you go from understanding how the club moves and making the ball go where you want it to go, and then at the end of the day, having a score at on the scorecard and how you went about doing that. So anyway, I don't know what kind of an answer that was, but
Absolutely. No, I think that's the exact direction we should end up going. And to kind of get a start on that, when we talk about the club moving through the ball, I think one of the good questions that good understandings that would be good for us is, without diving too deep into the golfing machine, kind of tell us how the advent of working with not just Sasho, but other guys and getting into this field has changed your understanding of the golf swing, some of the misconceptions that you had that have changed, because people still have a lot of those misconceptions. And we've talked just, we've talked with Sasha, we've interviewed him, we've talked with Marty, we've talked with a bunch of people in that realm. We actually just, our last one was with Chris Brody over there at Ping, who did Ballnamic and a bunch of other stuff. So we've been blessed to have a bunch of smart people on. Tell us about how yeah, your understanding changed in that regard, and things that maybe you taught students to do then that you wouldn't do now, that really the one of the catalysts for that was understanding how everything was functioning together.
Perfect example would be lag. You know, the Golf and Machine talked about lag quite a bit, and you know, whether the arms were lagging the body or the club were lagging the arms. I always, and the Golf and Machine had this thing called true throwout action. So I thought that if you got into a position where your hands were, you know, in front of your belly button, your right elbow was in front of your belly button, and the club was parallel to the ground, that was lag, and that there was going to be some magic principle that made the club shoot out really quickly and line up with your left arm at impact. So, you know, you went from this super lagging position to this inline condition where the club was going up your left arm, your lead arm at impact. And Homer Kelly, the guy that wrote the Golf Machine, and Ben Doyle, the first instructor of the Golf Machine, taught me and taught a lot of other people that there was this thing called true throwout action, and it's a fairy tale. I mean, the golfer is the one that throws it out, and so Sasha was like looking at me. We're talking about lag. This is about 10 years ago, and he's like, "Well, Mike," he goes, "you know, the club is getting in line with your left arm because you're doing it with your hands." And I'm like, "Oh, well, isn't there a principle where, like, law of the flail or something like that, that the club's just going to automatically line up if you pull hard enough?" And he's like, "No, that's not how it works. You don't get anything for free." So that would be one example, a major example, because students to this day come to me and say, "Well, tell me about lag, and you know, how can I get lag?" And I'm like, "Well, if you lag the club, you're going to have to unlag it. So in the middle of unlagging it, you create speed." So, you know, that's one clear example that I could use where the people that understand physics and how the golf club and the golfer interact, that would be a shining example of, you know, something that was like, "Whoa, okay, that makes a lot more sense," because the golfer's in charge of that, you know, whether it's with your hands or whether it's with the pulling motion, the golfer is doing all the work to get the club to line up with their lead arm. There's no magic principle that you can tap into by getting your right elbow into a certain position that's going to help you do that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, especially as someone who's familiar with some of the posts I've seen about it, et cetera. And maybe I think you've talked about it some on your Twitter. As far as I think that's a misconception that a lot of people, as you said, still have, both with lag and essentially anything. They think if they get to X position, then the club will naturally square up at impact. And in some ways, it does square up at impact, but only because you're making it do and you're applying the forces to the handle. And you said nothing comes for free. Tell us about how much, I guess what I'm specifically getting at, a lot of times, and again, I think I remember this correctly from your Twitter, a lot of times people think, oh, if I get it shallow enough or XYZ, whatever it is enough, I can just turn and turn through. And in reality, there is no almost free turning through. A lot of the hitting it straight, hitting and anything of that nature comes from, for better or for worse, using your hands and squaring it up, even though maybe it doesn't feel like that as much. Is that a correct statement? And tell us your direction on that.
Yeah, I think you might be referring to that video that I borrowed, quote unquote, from TPI. I think they had a face-on view of Jon Rahm hitting like a 6 iron or a 7 iron, kind of toward the camera, but just over the camera person, who I hope wasn't standing there because that would have hurt. But yeah, the golf club face is closing quite a bit on every full power golf swing. The golf club face is closing to the target on the downswing. And a lot of people, tour players included, think a lot of this squaring is done by just the pivot motion. When I say the pivot motion, I'm talking about the really big muscles, the torso, the hips, the thighs, all of those things that are turning, you know, open, I guess, through the golf shot. As the club is closing, a lot of people think, well, that pivot is what's squaring the golf club. And I'll stick to my guns here. I think if you ask Jon Rahm what squares his golf club, he would probably go to his pivot. So yeah, I just turn right through it. But in reality, his forearms and hands and the back of his hands are turning that golf club about itself. When I say it's turning around its long axis to close the face. And that rate is in the thousands, you know, the 1500 to 3500 degrees per second. And the body is down in the hundreds, you know, in the 300 degrees per second. So obviously it's much bigger. It's harder to turn as fast as the club because the club is smaller. But yeah, the hands and forearms are doing a majority of the squaring of the golf club. And so Sasho's stack doesn't have a club face. So he's famously says it's swing stick fast. You're not worried about the club face when you're swinging a stack, right? Because there is no club face. There's no ball to hit offline. So there's two real separate things in the golf swing, in my estimation. It's power production, swing stick fast, which the stack can help you swing it faster. And then what we just talked about, what are the squaring mechanisms to make the face be what you want it to be, whether it's zero for a straight shot or 2 degrees open for a draw or 2 degrees closed for a cut. How do you get there? And the forearm and hand twisting is sort of lost in the shuffle because we're so busy making the club go a 7 iron go 90 miles an hour. We're so busy doing that, we forget about the little 1 mile an hour twist, or one, you know, in angular speed terms, degrees per second, those little twists that make the ball go straight. And that I find that's a big part of my job is explaining that to people. And they are hesitant to change the way they twist around the club. But more often than not, it's necessary for the people that are hitting it offline, actually, you know.
And at the risk of beating a dead horse, or maybe getting this wrong, I think what I'm understanding and what I want clarified too is that, or at least maybe one of the common misconceptions is that golfers, like we already talked about squaring, how that's a misconception, but that theoretically, even in that vein, people think, oh, if I could get someone into the right positions, they'll automatically square. And I guess what I'm getting at is like hitting straight, unfortunately, like there are ways to practice more efficiently, but hitting the ball straight and hitting straight shots at high speeds invariably requires lots of practice because not lots as in like infinity practice, but going from 0 to 100 or going from 18 handicap to 2 handicap is going to require a lot of practice for most people. No matter what, because you are working, because while you might have certain positions that help you feel the club better to square it, feel the club better, which helps you square it better potentially, at the end of the day, you're making these tiny adjustments with your forearms, back of your hand, et cetera, to get that club square within a degree, either way, essentially square. And because you're making these small movements, and especially the people who aren't experienced, the only way to get the essentially the only way to hit it straight is to practice. And while you're not maybe consciously thinking about those things, you are inevitably getting better at that squaring mechanism. And guys like Jon Rahm have gotten so good at that squaring mechanism, they don't even notice that, oh, I'm squaring it with my hands, because that's just part of their golf swing and their brain reacting to it. Is that a fair assessment? Am I on the right track with that?
100%. John Rahm is numb to that, those squaring mechanisms that he's using. He's numb to it. He doesn't feel it. And if you suggested to him to twist on that club a different way, he'd probably push back on you for a little bit. But if it helped him hit better shots, he'd learn it, and then he'd become numb to that new action. And so, you know, and I think you've kind of touched on it a few times, so I sort of want to cover it, because the shallowing part, and this is a very difficult thing to even talk about in person, much less on a little conference call like this. But Sasho has discovered that the overall club center of mass, which is kind of where the balance point is, if you put your finger under the shaft, and that center of mass, when it gets below where your hands are forcing the club, the net force that you're pulling on the club, and most everybody won't get this, but some might, when it falls below that little instantaneous direction of the net force that you're pulling on the grip, there are some squaring. There's There's some swearing mechanisms that will help you square the golf club later in the downswing. It's like a seesaw. You know, you get the club on one side of your hands. It wants to line up with where the hands are going or where they're forcing the club to go. And it's just like pulling a wagon around the corner. And I know that's not the greatest explanation in the world, but Sasho has discovered that. I don't teach shallowing to anybody. There's kids that show up on my lesson tee that shallow the crud out of it. And then there's guys that maybe steepen a little bit that still play really good golf. But I would say majority, the shaft is kind of pretty quiet, or maybe it's moving to a little bit shallower place. And so, like a friend of mine, Vijay Trolio, is a teacher down in Mississippi. His son, Cohen Trolio, got to the semifinals of the USAM a couple of years ago when he was really young before he got to college. He shallows the crud out of it. I guarantee you, Vijay didn't teach him that. I guarantee you. I mean, he did it. I mean, I'll blank on some names, but there are some guys that just really just go, you know, immediately in transition that hit the
Neiman.
crud out of it. Yeah, maybe you.
No, I'm
So,
Joachim Neiman.
oh yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, it helps them hit the golf ball, but then you find guys that the shaft looks really, really quiet in transition and doesn't steepen or shallow, and there's reasons for that because the golfer's balancing the desire for the shaft to be shallow and for the desire to shaft to steepen, and they have it balanced out, and the shaft looks really quiet as they come down, and those swings maybe are more pleasing to the eye to some people. But it really doesn't matter. The golf ball doesn't really care whether the club is being shallowed or staying where it is. The ball is hit, and it's so fast, the contact, the impact interval is so quick that it doesn't. All that stuff is just baloney. I mean, all the stuff you see down the line, instructors looking at, you know, where the club is at the top in relation to an anatomical body part. It's just so blown out of proportion and such a waste of time. I can't even, it's sad because I see that all the time. And the one silver lining of people micromanaging these positions is they're actually out on the range working on something. And if they're out there working on something, maybe that will benefit their game. Maybe if they're out there 6 hours worrying about what plane, quote unquote, the shaft is on, they just practice for 6 hours. Maybe it doesn't matter what plane they were on, but it mattered that they just practice for 6 hours. So maybe they'll shoot a better score the next day because of that practice, not because of the mechanic they were working on.
I want to dive in a little deeper, and I'll take a gander at maybe under explaining slash understanding. We'll see if I understand it, and then maybe it'll help listeners too. When we talk about what you mentioned there, as far as the fulcrum of the club, I think is the center of mass might be where if you took the club and you set it out on your hand, and you tried to balance it so it sat square, where it sits square where the side of the head is even with the side of the shaft, and it's not falling off your finger or something like that. That's where the center of mass of the club is. And then
That's close, yes. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
it's ballpark. And then wherever we apply force to the handle, the club head is rotating around that center of mass, essentially. And so if I, it's like a in a golf swing, you might imagine it like a speedboat or something like that. If I had a skier on the back of my speedboat, and I drove dead straight with that skier, the skier stays dead behind. So if I pulled directly on the shaft with the force in line with the shaft, that club head would stay moving in line with that shaft because it's in line with the center of mass. Whereas if I, like a speedboat, again, took a hard turn, I'd be applying a force against the handle around that center of mass, and the club would rotate like a water skier would rotate around that center of mass and shoot out the right side. So if I turn left with the speedboat really hard, that skier would shoot out to the right. And that's what we're talking about with I think with Sasha, with the potential shallowing effect, is that by getting Is that correct? By getting that center of mass lower when we're talking about shallowing, and then we pull on the handle, that club is naturally wanting to line. The club wants to get in line with the shaft no matter what. And so, because whatever direction we're applying the force on the handle, the club wants to get in line with that force. And so, is that ballpark right? Is that where we're getting at with that?
Yes. So the club rotates around the center of mass. And I know this is somewhat difficult to kind of picture, but there's two ways to do it. And what you were describing the entire time was what Sasha would call the moment of force. And so you pull on the grip in a direction, and then that line of action either intersects with the center of mass or misses it. When it misses it, then there's rotation of the club. However, there's a second way to rotate the club is with your hands. He calls it the hands couple. It's basically the golfer. And when the club is going slow, you're able to manhandle and manipulate the club with the hands couple. And so that has to blend in with the moment of force. So basically, the golf swing is a blending of what you just described, the force on pulling on the handle and how that affects or how that intersects or doesn't intersect with the center of mass, which causes rotation, blending with you being able to manhandle the club with the hands couple. And when the club is going slow, you can manhandle it easier. So early takeaway, transition. When the club is moving slow, you can really manhandle it. Joaquin Neiman and Cohen Troglio, those guys are manhandling that club early on in the downswing. But as the club speeds up, the moment of force, what you were describing, the pulling of the grip really takes over any of the club's rotation. And I know there's somebody out there listening to this going, what in the heck are these guys talking about? And believe me, I understand. And you're not going to get a lecture like this if you come to take a lesson from me, but I understand why the club is doing what it does. And maybe I can help them add or subtract one of those two things to make the club do something different. And they don't need to be explained all of this, but you know, hey, we're sitting around talking about this. We might as well try to understand it as best we can. So, anyway, yeah, you described Sasha's moment of force very well with the ski boat analogy. Yeah.
Okay, and I promise we'll move in just a second to golf lessons, tournaments, et cetera. I just wanted to get that clarity on that. And as a follow-up to it, I mean, that's one of those concepts. Again, I like playing good golf. I don't play a lot of good golf right now, but I like playing good golf. I like being a good golfer. I want to play well in tournaments, but the theory interests me, especially without diving too much into a lot of my old golf, what I would call my old golf game, et cetera. To me, it's important to understand why things work the way that they work, because I spent a lot of time as a junior golfer, college golfer, and after that, I spent a lot of time with the wrong models in my head. And for better or worse, I have models in my head of how things work. And so, because I had bad models in my head, I spent time practicing things that not even had a neutral effect, or at least I was practicing. It had negative effects on my golf game. And once I got rid of those bad models, it helped me reason for first principles, understanding the principles. I could reason for first principles. Okay, ballpark, here's what I need to be thinking about. And then whenever another idea popped in my head, or I work with an instructor, but whenever any of those things come up, I'm like, okay, or I got a lesson, or I'd get a lesson from an instructor, and the instructor would tell me something. And no offense to instructors that I don't listen to, but they tell me something like, that doesn't comport with how I know any of this works together. I think I'm just going to ignore that thing that they said, which you should vet out instructors and not take ones you don't agree with. But, or I shouldn't say that. I'll digress on that point. But what I'm really getting at is that I think that feeling, while the idea of the center of mass is confusing as a golfer, or to a golfer who hasn't thought about it much, watched videos on it, or anything like that, I think that feeling is one of those feelings, once you understand, that I think is important to feel, or at least understand, because you feel it in your golf swing sometimes. And once you start feeling it going both ways, like that feeling of being steep, and at least to me, when I get, if I ever get steeper or over the top, is that feeling my hands coming down to the ball and that club actually like trying to get back in line with the shaft in a really weird, in a really weird way. So then if you imagine a hand path moving perfectly in line with the ball, and it feels like your hand path goes from outside of the ball to inside the ball, and then you have to get it back out to be able to make contact with the ball. That's what over the top a lot of times feel like to me. Whereas being a little shallower, or coming the what I would say coming from the other direction, feels a little better to me because it feels like my hands start from inside the ball. And this isn't actually what's going on, but I'm just saying like directionally start from inside, are working out, and then are pulling back around. And I don't feel like you have, and I don't feel that much manipulation. And when I feel XYZ, I know, all right, here's probably what's going on there. So now that I've talked about that a lot, you said student comes to me, I'm not getting this kind of lesson. Tell me when students are coming to you and you're getting ready for a golf tournament. Tell me what you're working one in general when you're with in a lesson with a student, it's student led. What are you working on? What are the things that you're telling them to help them get to play better? And when they're going off and practicing on their own, what are you telling them to make sure that they're practicing the right things, but not getting lost in where the center in the forces they're applying to the handle?
Yeah, we're definitely not talking about that. I mean, all your work is done before you tee it up, you put the peg in the ground, all the work is done. I tell all my students, and so I'm a coach at a local high school, at St. Xavier High School now. I started coaching them last year, and so I have that experience, and also all the junior golfers and amateur golfers and professional golfers that I've worked with over the years. Obviously, we talk about, tournament golf, and all the hay is in the barn before they tee it up. There's no more balls to be hit. There's no more putts to be hit. There's no more chips to practice. You're going out and you for 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours sometimes, unfortunately, you got to be out there doing your thing. And so for the golfer to lament, oh wow, I really wish I had hit 50 more 5 irons because I got a 5 iron right now over a lake to a par five. I hit a perfect drive and now I've got to hit this 5 iron in this par five. Got a lake on the left and the wind's out of the right. And how do I hit this shot? And rather than lamenting, hey, I wish I had practiced this shot a little bit more, it's already done. The work is done. And and I guess I'm talking about better players right now, but that's what I try to give them, that mindset. Hey, right now we're in a 4 hour, 5 hour printout of where you are with your game today. And don't be sad that you didn't work on certain shots because that's what you chose to do, and let's go out and play. When you put the peg into the ground, I'm a big encourager of not having any swing thoughts. Just being, picturing shots and then printing them out. Just reacting, pushing a button, whatever trigger that you have when you're over the golf ball, you're like a factory worker. Stamping out a car door at the Ford factory. You just boom, 5 iron, boom, driver, boom, wedge, boom, driver, boom, 9 iron. And you just go shot by shot. All the work is done. So there's really no pressure, right? Because you're at the level that you're at. And let's go find out what it is today. And then, hey, I didn't do this well. I didn't hit my driver well. Well, let's go hit 30 drivers and figure it out. So that's a really general thoughts that I give students, but I mean, to go out there and to have any type of, obviously, if somebody has one swing thought, I would allow that. But if you're trying to think about more than one thing, you're toast. I would prefer zero things if I had my druthers. So, anyway, I don't know if I answered your question there, but
Just so people know, St. Xavier's not your average high school golf team. Justin Thomas was an alumni there, and when I was in high school, they won two state championships. So that's pretty cool that they have someone like you coaching them. And I believe that your son is still on the team.
No, Jackson, it graduated in 22. He just finished his second year at the University of Cincinnati, and He's amateur golfer and looking forward getting ready for his summer play.
Yeah, I'd like you to talk some about, coaching him growing up and how you've balanced teaching him how to play the game, teaching him the golf swing, and also being his dad.
Yeah, he just walked out a few minutes ago. He's going out to the club to practice. It's been great. I pushed basketball early on. I love basketball. I loved playing competitive basketball when I was young, and so I really pushed Jackson into basketball, and he loved it too. And so golf was a little bit of a secondary sport up until 11, 12 years old, but when everybody started getting about a half a foot bigger than him, he realized that maybe his future was in golf a little bit more than in basketball. Although he's a pretty good little player. But so yeah, he started taking it fairly serious around 11, 12 as far as tournament golf. And I tried to keep things fairly simple with him. I know he's exposed to like me listening to me do talks like this with my friends and other teachers and other guys like Sasha McKenzie. He's been in that world for 10 years now, listening to me have those discussions. So it's difficult for me to keep some of the stuff that I'd probably rather keep from him out of his head, because I want him playing free. But he's done a really good job of that. I would say he's not a technical player at all. He's much more of a feel player, maybe to his detriment sometimes. Maybe he's a little bit too feely. Maybe he needs to be a little bit more regimented and, just taking in his yardages and his launch and spin and control of that. And maybe he needs to be a little bit better. I mean, I think Matthew Fitzpatrick would be on one end of the spectrum. He's charting every shot that he hits in tournament play and in practice. And Jackson's a little bit more, hey, I'm going to go work on my mid iron approaches for a half hour, and then I'm going to go work on my distance wedges for 45 minutes and go putt. And so he's a little bit more feel based, coming from a dad who is maybe the ultimate looking into mechanics, since he's been alive. And so it's been interesting to watch his progression. I know he was super good junior golfer, has. He redshirted his first year at Cincinnati, so he plateaued a little bit. I think he figured out how much work he needs to put into it this past year at Cincinnati, played some golf for them this year. And I think also he's a super talented kid, and it's in his court. If he decides that he wants to take his game up 6, 7, 8, 9 levels, it's up to him. And he's going out there today. He needs to get better today. And all of the kids I work with, same thing. It's all in front of them. I'm 1% of the equation, or if that, they're 99% of the equation of where they want to be. I can make, and I tell parents this all the time, of good junior golfers, I make sure that they don't fall off cliffs. I've got really good players that come into me and they're swinging 8 degrees left on TrackMan. I'm like, what in the heck has happened in the last month for you to get off to do this? And I push them back closer to zero. Don't make them get to zero. You want to hit a cut? Let's be -2. You want to hit a draw? Let's be +2 pathwise, and let's figure out how to get there and make the ball do what you want it to do. But yeah, it's fun working with kid. And Jackson's a super talented kid, but I've got 20 Jacksons that I work with. Lucky, blessed to work with kids talented like him. That are pursuing their dreams. Guys like, you two, a few years ago, same way. And, and I'm in the same boat as you two. I was a pretty good junior player. I played golf, college golf at LSU, but I didn't really make it past much competitive golf after that. I played obviously in section stuff at the PGA level, but never. And my roommate at LSU was David Toms, and he won $40 million on tour. And although Scottie Scheffler will probably win that this year. But I mean, he won 13 times. And so I saw what it took for guys like David to get to the top level. And then I saw myself and thousands of other guys like me maybe not make it. So it's a crazy game, but it's fun. It's a fun pursuit.
I think Cooper and I were just talking about that the other day, as far as playing. Not everyone can play D1 golf exactly, but golf is a unique sport compared to a lot of other sports, I think, in multiple ways. One, almost every player is a 4-year player. So your roster is a little bit more stuff than maybe a basketball team, which, all right, after a year, two, three, guys might be going. But for most of the time, I mean, there are guys that are obviously really good, but for most of the time, you're not having guys leave college early for golf, except in limited circumstances. Caleb Surratt being one of them,
Yeah, Nick
who've had
Dunlap.
on
Yeah.
great, yeah, Nick Dunlap, a couple guys, but it's not that common. So as a freshman, it's harder to play, but also with golf, while there are athletic components involved, it's not an unathletic sport. It's a sport that is very unnatural, I would say, to human movement. Like shooting a basketball is pretty unnatural, or pretty natural for human movement, relatively speaking. It's pretty, in some ways, simple motion. And so getting good at basketball or getting good at soccer is maybe more, there's more athleticism slash natural coordination you build up throughout existence than golf, which is almost always a foreign phenomenon to swing a golf club, hit a golf ball, make ball go straight with a stick swinging 100 miles per hour was not in our caveman brain at all. And so it's a unique sport in the sense that I think golf, almost more than any other sport, it is you're more capable as a junior golfer, especially at playing golf at a D1 level than maybe any other sport, but it just takes lots of work, because you're in some ways. And then, similarly, if you are out of school and you're trying to become a 2 handicap or a scratch golfer, if you're older and you want to become a scratch golfer, it's easier to do that than it is for you to become that level of basketball player. Because again, while it takes work and time, it doesn't take a lot of the things that other people might be more naturally. Golf doesn't take advantage of athleticism as much. Now we're seeing more athletes in golf. We're seeing faster swing speeds from people working on it, which they can grow and develop, but also from having more athletic players involved in the game, I would say. But all that to say is it takes a lot of practice and work, I think, to get there, but it's achievable when you're working with your students who want to play golf at the next level. And they, what are you recommending to them as far as generally speaking on practice? And then there was a point that I didn't want to miss, so just hold this in the back of your mind and come through it later. When you're at a tournament, we were talking about tournaments, and don't want anything in your head. When you're on the range and they're hitting the ball poorly, is there anything you tell them to do? Or so it's just like, hey, you got what you got today. Like, you'll figure it out when you get out there.
Two really good questions. As far as how what they're working on to prepare for events, I think the launch spin is a huge thing. I'm the good players that I work with control their launch and spin much better than the ones that don't play as well, and their ability to manipulate that through shaft lean, through what club that they choose and the speed that they swing it. Like for the guys that are hitting the sand wedges into the wind, that are ripping it off the front of greens with backspin, they have to learn how to swing one club up a little bit slower with a little bit less shaft lean to create less spin. And I mean that's a big thing, and then it doesn't just come into play with wedges, although that's a big thing in tournament golf, being able to control your wedges when they land on the green. The same thing can be said about 7 irons, 6 irons, 5 irons, in windy conditions, being able to lean the shaft the right amount. And then, if you're backing the ball up in your stance and you're leaning the shaft a little bit more and you're hitting more down on it and your path's going more out to right field, knowing how to swing a little bit further left to account for that happening to make the ball go straighter, making into the wind and crosswind, well, mostly into the wind shots with 5 iron and up. 5 iron, 4 iron, 3 iron, 2 iron, 3 wood. That is where I think a lot of tournament golf is separated. I really do. I think there's a lot of guys that can hit their 7 iron through sand wedge pretty well. Some can't, but most everybody can. But when you start getting into the 5 iron, up to the 3 wood, into the wind, making the ball go straight is a challenge, and especially in tournament golf. And so to get back to what they should work on, yeah, I mean, I think obviously the course they're about to play, should drive that. I mean, if they're playing a 6,800 yard golf course nowadays, that's a lot of wedges in, right? If they're playing something that's 7,300 yards and they're going to be hitting a lot of longer stuff, tailor your practice toward the golf course that you're about to play. The width of the fairways and how many times you're going to hit driver, how sharp do you have to be? If there's a lot of holes where you need to back down, how can you hit your 3 wood off of a tee, a low tee? How well are you going to do that? So tailoring the practice to the course that you're about to play is super important to me. Obviously you can't forget putting speed, getting a feel for the greens in a practice round or a prior round, and being able to control your speed on lag putting is a huge, huge part of it. And getting familiar with green speeds, and then just the overall slope of the golf course, to understand maybe some putts that might be sneaky fast or sneaky slow because of the way that I grew up in Louisiana, dead flat, didn't have to worry about that a lot. But in Kentucky and around here, you have to worry about that a little bit more. So as far as when a student is hitting it poorly, do I say just go with what you got? Unfortunately, yeah, that's probably what you got to do. I'll get video from guys that are panicking, the day before an event, and they're like, "Can you see anything on video?" I can't see anything on video, man. I mean, unless something has fundamentally changed, we're talking about, 2 degrees, 3 degrees on a club face, you miss the green, right? And I can't see 2 degrees on a video, or 3 degrees, or 10 degrees for that matter. I mean, you can see where the ball's starting off and kind of know where the face was pointing, but to be able to look at a video and say, "Oh, this is where you're off. This is what you need to fix," I'd be lying to them. So I try not to lie as much as I can to my students.
That's good. That's one of the things that Cooper does that I really like is before tournaments, he takes a video of his golf swing. Not to fix it, but just to put a marker as to where he's at. And so it's been helpful when he and I have gone back and looked at some things. Like there was a tournament that he played in that he just, there's a period of time where he's just hitting it all over the place. And then eventually things got better. He did some work with an instructor to help get it around. And then
There's a
we looked back. Go ahead. Yeah, take a coop.
yeah, there's a tournament a few years ago where I'd taken a video before the qualifier, and I didn't think much of it. And then I played good enough in the qualifier, I got through. And then 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I played in the tournament. I'm still hitting it everywhere. I'm like, well, what the hell happened between the time that I qualified and the time that I played in the tournament? And to be honest, my swing didn't change that much. It just happened to be that I could get it around that day, and I ended up shooting a decent score, but the swing was had the same flaws.
Right.
Yeah, and that was the Jones Cup qualifier and the Jones Cup. And so especially once you get out to Ocean Forest versus Sea or Sea Island, the flaws are
In the
even more
wind.
noticeable. Yeah.
But also, I think when I was growing up as a junior, I was maybe afraid to look at my own swing because, I didn't really know what I was looking at. I was like, I don't want to overanalyze this and worry about the wrong things. But if you can have like a healthy relationship, I guess you would say, with looking at your swing on video, it's probably the best outcome.
Right.
Do you, I'm assuming you advise your juniors to not look at their swing on video too much?
No, not really. I mean, I mean, obviously there's kids that overanalyze their swing quite a bit, and that are constantly videoing, and so I have to talk them off of doing that too often. But yeah, having some checks and shoot, I like putting an iPhone down on the ground on the ball line, and then that works like a TrackMan face angle. If you put it right on the ball line, you can kind of see, and if you have it lined up with a distant flag and you can see both, you can see how the ball takes off, and you've got a pretty good idea of where club face is that day. And boy, that's the most important data point on TrackMan is face angle. And so shoot, if you can use video for that, I fuss at my kids that are constantly sending me stuff and saying, "Well, what's different here? What's different here?" And it's like, "I saw you yesterday, man. There's nothing different." And you got to understand, this is not about your next swing. It's about your next 100 swings as a group. Let's try to make 75 good swings out of the next 100, as opposed to 65 of the last 100. And that you got to look at groups of swings and groups of tournament rounds, and instead of one tournament round or one swing. And not just juniors, adults too, they just freak out over one bad shot or two bad shots. And explain it to me, explain it to me. It's like, I don't know, man. I don't know why you made 20 swings with a zero face, and then all of a sudden you had a 6-degree open face. I could guess at a couple of things if you want me to, but why did you freak out and leave the face 6 degrees open on that shot and hit it over that roof? I mean, there's I cannot tell you. I'm just we're looking for groups of shots to get better, not just one individual shot. And some people don't like that answer. And they well, I'm just going to go to somebody else that'll make up a fairy tale for them so they'll feel better about themselves. And I just don't make up fairy tales. And when I don't know something, I'll tell the student I don't know. I'm trying to learn more. And I hope other instructors are doing the same, but I don't feel like fibbing to students for their betterment is the way to go. I'd say, hey, look, I don't know. We just need to do a better job of, the face angle, and we can get into this a little bit, is the grip orientation and how you twist around the grip on the downswing. That's going to be face control, and we just need to do a better job of both of those: gripping it the same way, and then twisting on it the same way. And your pivot's going to be there to make the club go fast, but the grip and the twist is going to be what's lining up the club to hit it. So anyway, I went off on a tangent there, but
No, that's helpful. When it comes to we're close to wrapping up here, but if just a few more questions. I want to ask a question about full swing, then I want to ask some about short game. When it comes to that grip orientation, I mean, every student comes to you with their a priori. So if you have a I imagine if you have a good student, a lot of times we hear if I have a good student coming to me that's really good and is hitting the ball well and their grip is kind of weird. We just kind of work around. We work with what we got, and we're not fitting them into a mold. And that's similar to what you said, is you don't put people in patterns. What, generally speaking, though, there are grips or patterns that work best for squaring up the face, all things being equal. What's the general your general orientation as to, like, what are the check marks that you're looking for a student's grip?
yeah, for sure. So I think what I think, quote unquote, is neutral is you take your arm and you extend it from your shoulder out straight. And I don't know, I can't do this on video here. And then the back of your left wrist, your lead wrist, is level with your forearm. And that would be arched and bent. This would what extended and flexed, whatever, flat. I like a flat left wrist with the back of your forearm at shoulder height. And then at the same time, at when you put the club inside your hands, the leading edge of the club is facing the sky, is perpendicular to the sky. That's how I teach the lead hand grip. The right hand grip, the trail hand grip, is like you're shooting a little water pistol, and that second joint in your right index finger is on the back side of the grip pointing toward the target. But the what I find myself mostly worried about is the lead hand. I'm not saying that it does all the work, because it doesn't. Both hands do a lot of work on that. But neutral grips, like what I just said, I feel like for the long-term development of somebody, that's where they should start. If you develop a little bit of a strong grip or a little bit of a weak grip, I'm fine with that. Obviously, that cascades through your golf swing and makes other parts of your golf swing potentially look different. because if you have a stronger grip, you might have to get a little bit more open with your body. If you have a weaker grip, you may have to be a little bit more squared and packed, or whatever the case may be, to kind of to gel with the grip orientation. But grip orientation, the important thing is to settle on a grip and then keep that grip the same shot to shot to shot to shot. And then you add on the insult of skin twists, the glove twists. There's a lot of give in that, and that makes the game random too. I mean, you got 15 degrees probably of skin and bone and glove give inside your left hand. So like, okay, 15 degrees on TrackMan, you don't play golf, right? I mean, if you're 15 closed or 15 open. So that's what makes the game tough. But I like starting with neutral grips. Like you said, though, if somebody comes to me and they've got a super strong grip and they're just knocking the flag down, I'm not changing the grip. But when they get to the point where they're not knocking the flag down, maybe we have that discussion. Maybe we need to weaken a little bit and see what our results are, and I go from there.
It's funny you say that's how you get students to get to neutral, because that's Cooper taught me that one. I don't remember where he picked it up at, but that's Cooper's pre-shot routine and now my pre-shot routine too. I just
Oh yeah.
as part of it is grab the club with our left hand.
Larry Ward taught me. I'm assuming got it from you.
Yeah, I don't know. So I saw Lee Trevino about 25 years ago, was doing a little clinic for some people, and he's basically holding the club up above and saying, "Yeah, you got two club faces, the back of your left hand and the club face over here." And Brian Manzella was the one that showed me down in New Orleans. This is years ago. Showed it. So everything that I have is stolen from somebody at some point in time, right? So if Larry borrowed that from Brian or myself, or I'm pretty sure Brian showed it to me before I knew who Larry Ward was. So I don't know if Larry got that from Brian or not, but Brian probably got it from Lee Trevino, and Lee Trevino probably got it from somebody else.
Well, that's crazy to me that, Lee Trevino or whoever, kind of just figured that out by, I guess, hitting a lot of balls and figuring it out.
Talk about a guy that hit a lot of golf balls. And it's funny to see him even to this day. He's like got a super mad at golf instructors. He hated that Chris Cuomo was working with Tiger Woods. He hated it because he just thought Tiger didn't need anybody, which he probably is right. But I mean, Lee Trevino is, he's as anti-teacher as you can be. In a nice way, but he's like, just figure it out. It's like, he doesn't, no, you guys don't need to. It's so, it wasn't easy for him to figure out. He worked and worked and worked, but then now he realizes, well, so I'm here. Everybody else should be here. So I don't think Lee would be a great instructor, to be honest with you. I think because he did it so many times and it's come so natural to him, I don't think he would have any compassion for somebody trying to get better at the game. Although maybe he would, and I don't want to badmouth Lee Trevino, obviously one of the greatest players that ever played, but I don't know. That's kind of my thoughts there.
Completely understand. I think one question I had for you, we talk about short game, we talk about a lot of people you run with, and so I want to talk about a combination of that. I think you're from Kentucky, and you I
I'm
think
from
I saw
Louisiana. I'm from New
or
Orleans.
well sorry
I,
you've been
no,
in
you're good.
Kentucky
You're
for a
good.
while,
Yeah,
you've been in
I
Kentucky
have
for a
been, yes,
while,
30 years.
and so you know some Kentucky people, and there's a couple, and you also obviously know the Maestro and some guys in like that, and they're all kind of in the same group. And Cooper and I've been trying to understand this. Obviously, the Maestro hasn't brought around anything new in the world per se, but it's shown through with the short game stuff. There's nothing new under the sun, but has helped measure and explain why, for some short game shots, being steep, or it's not the right term to use, but we'll leave it
I'll
that.
say I don't get it. I don't think, well, Daniel maybe understands it a little better than me, but we both go out to the course. I'm like, I'm trying to do what this guy says on Instagram, but I don't get it. And then I talk to other people at the course that like I didn't even know that you guys follow this guy, and they're asking me questions about it. I don't know what it
Let me get to where I was going with that too.
means.
So anyway, there's before there's like a lot of times in everything there's quote unquote camps, and I've heard Joe say, like I just think steep is good in some cases, and in certain cases you want to be shallow. Cooper's worked with Jeff Pierce before on short game, and when Jeff was teaching him, it was a lot
Shallow.
shallower.
It's all shallow.
It was a lot more shallow. Maestro, obviously, at least in some shots, is more of a steep pattern. What kind of pattern are you? Is there a pattern that you lean towards with your students? Obviously, it's shot dependent, but there's overarching theories for people in even like similar shots where they might have shallow versus steep. So, kind of tell us where you fall in that camp.
Interesting. It's funny because I'm in a little text string with Joe and Jeff and a few other guys, and it's so funny to hear those guys go back and forth. But I know Jeff respects Joe and Joe respects Jeff, so we have to understand what we're talking about first. It's you got two different numbers. You got attack angle, and you have they used to call it vertical swing plane. They just call it swing plane now on TrackMan. So those are two different things. And I think maybe if somebody's listening to this, they need to understand both. Attack angle is what our traditional thoughts are. You know, how is the plane landing? How abruptly is the club coming down into the golf ball? You know, from a face-on view, you know, how abruptly is the club coming down onto the golf ball? So on a regular pitch shot that Jason Day might be hitting, maybe he's four down with a sand wedge off of a tight lie, four or five down, whatever. Maybe he's more than that, but anyway, 4 degrees down, let's say. But separately from attack angle is the plane, and stay with me here because this is super important. The plane that the club head only swings on the downswing. Not the shaft, not the shaft. The shaft disappears. It's just the head. Think about the head. Think about videoing somebody from down the line on a 30-yard pitch shot. Okay. And you stop the video where the club is just below parallel to the ground. So it's coming down, about to hit the golf ball, or, you know, a few feet away, 5 feet, 4 feet away. And you put a dot on that. And then you click frame advance and you put a dot, a dot, a dot. Anyway, those dots, you can run a plane, a best fit plane through that, those dots, and that circle will be at a certain angle. That is the vertical swing plane, or what TrackMan calls now the swing plane. And what Joe, I think it's sort of almost changed. We talked about that. Joe and I talked about this about 4 months ago. It used to be that he wanted to talk mostly about attack angle, about being 9, 10 down on a tight lie, creating the spin and the launch conditions through a pretty steep attack angle. He's talking more and more and more now about the swing plane that the head is swinging on. A club, a sand wedge, correct me if I'm wrong, is built on like a 65 degree angle, the shaft into the head. Let's just say 65. A lot of the good pitchers of the golf ball are swinging it on a 75 degree angle, 80 degree angle. They're not swinging it on the angle that it was built on. They're not swinging it on the angle that that you think you need to swing it on. They're swing. So if you think about it, like from the down the line perspective, that club head is a little bit outside the hands, and then it's coming down outside the hands a little bit more steeply. And when I think about this, I think about Seve Ballesteros, watching him hit pitch shots in New Orleans when I was a kid, and how abruptly the club would come up, and how it's basically the plane that the head swings down on. And I think Joe is kind of gravitating a little bit more toward talking about the vertical swing plane being 75, 80, 85. It would be tough to be 90. That would be a Ferris wheel, just straight up and straight down. But I think what you find is that you can have a shallow attack angle with a vertical swing plane, and you can have a steep attack angle with a vertical swing plane. And then you could swing it around your body. So basically, the moral to the story is people that suck that club in around them on pitch shots, they struggle. They struggle because they're swinging it more on a 55 degree swing plane, or something lower than what the club is built on. And those are the ones that run into the ground a lot of times, drop kick it. And the more vertical your swing plane is, and if it coincides that it's a little bit more steep and you're a little bit in front of the ball, to lean the shaft and create launch and spin that you need, that goes along with it too. But those are two separate numbers, and we have to make sure that we understand that they are two separate numbers. But you can, if you have access to a TrackMan, take it out and hit some pitch shots and take a look at those two numbers. Just pull up attack angle and swing plane and play around with it and get the club outside your hands and have the club come down a little bit more like a Ferris wheel, as opposed to, you know, dragging it kind of low to the ground and low to the ground. And you'll find, and I've personally done it too, you'll find that you maybe make better contact with the more vertical swing plane and a little bit more down. And then this another part to this whole thing is how Joe wants you to not make a divot. And that's, you know, preparing the club's going down, and then you just prepare to yank the handle up so you don't make a divot. And a part of that is the sole of the club, and you've got the face a little bit open, and so that sole doesn't want to dig. You know, it's not the leading edge going into the ground. So you can hit these shots with these super high down attacks and super high vertical swing planes and still figure out how to not make a divot. And that's what I think Victor Hovland was showing late last year before he and Joe parted ways on a few of those videos that kind of snuck out, and he was chipping the ball pretty well. I hope I didn't butcher that. I hope Joe's
No.
not mad at me for what I just said.
I think the and there's like those videos that TaylorMade did with Tiger and Scotty. They're all those guys talking about
Oh
chipping.
yeah.
And I think that it could just be as simple as where in one of those videos they're like, you know, when I set up to hit this chip shot, I kind of feel like the heels off the ground in my address. And like it sounds like it could just be as simple as something like that would create that
Yeah. So if your
higher
heel's off the
swing
ground,
plane
that means
angle.
your hands are higher, and then you get closer to the ball, you might be able to swing that head on a more vertical swing plane. But you're right. I think there's a massive misunderstanding for teachers, for students, for everybody, that the angle of the shaft is what matters. It obviously it matters, but I think it pales in comparison to what the head is actually doing on its own, just the head, because you don't have to swing it on the angle that the shaft is on, especially on short shots, because you can manipulate it really easy. On longer shots, I sort of like having the vertical swing plane and the static lie angle of the club, 761 degrees. I like seeing the vertical swing plane, the swing plane, be close to that number. And I have students that are way under that number and way above it, that are good players, that we're kind of working trying to get those two numbers to kind of match up a little bit better. The static lie angle of the club and then the vertical swing plane number on TrackMan, those should be close. And I think the best players hitting, when they're hitting it best, those numbers are close together. I don't have any hard, fast data on that, but I've talked to a lot of smart people and they all seem to agree. And I think that's something that probably will be looked at a lot more in the coming future. I think I might look at it actually, and maybe with some of my better players, and try to get some data on that, because I think there's something there to that. And throw in another number, I'm sorry, but the dynamic lie, that's when TrackMan measures the leading edge and then the hosel. You know, what angle is that on? And that number should be close on full swings. We're back to full swings now. We're not talking about pitch shots, but anyway, really interesting stuff. I love thinking about this. And I think Joe's onto something. I really do. Did Joe discover it? No, he uncovered it. He re maybe put some attention to it. And there's people that have three down attacks that can pitch the crap out of the ball. And then there's guys that have 10 down attacks that can do the same. And then they've got bad versions of both of those too. So I don't think it's a be all end all, but it certainly is something to worth looking at.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've had a great conversation, really enjoyed it, and I think it leads perfectly into our last question. I know we talked a lot about technical stuff. We talked some about tournament stuff. All of it was good. This one is a two-part question for you. So if you go back to yourself as a junior golfer and tell yourself just one thing, what would that one thing be? And then the second part is, if you could tell a junior golfer just one thing, what would that one thing be?
Okay, what am I telling myself, and then what I would tell a current junior golfer, like to
Correct.
be better? Okay,
Correct.
I was told a lot to hit down on the ball when I was a kid. I really wish I could go back in time and understand that when I want to hit down on it, but my hands don't want to keep going down. I want my hands to went from a face on view. I want my hands to be their lowest in front of my right thigh, and then be on the rise when they get to my left thigh. So I want my hands going up, but the club still going down. So I wouldn't overlean it, over. I hit it over the green a lot. I didn't have numbers on it, but I know I was underspinning shots out of light rough my whole junior and college career, probably mostly my college career, and just shortly after that, I was probably overleaning the club and not spinning it the right amount, so I'd hit it too far with my irons. What would I tell a young junior golfer right now? There's a blending of play and practice that you need to do. You can't just go out there and play all day and expect to get where you want to get. You can't expect to just practice all day and expect to get where you want to get. There has to be a blending of the two. And then the play part, that there has to be a blending of play, casual play, and tournament play. It can't be all tournament play and it can't be all casual play, obviously. So you got to blend the golf experience, the playing experience, to competitive and just casual play. And then you've got to form some good practice habits and getting out and working on specific parts of your game for a period of time. But you also have to get out and play some casual golf with your friends and for a couple dollars to kind of put some pressure on yourself and go out and develop that way. So that's what I would tell a current junior golfer.
Excellent. Well, the underspinning thing was funny because you're talking to the king of the flyer right here. I was a king of a fly,
Yeah.
king of the flyers as the junior, as a junior golfer, knew how to do that pretty well. Excellent. Where can people find you on social media? Where can they book a lesson with you? Any of that kind of stuff.
Social media is mostly Twitter. It will X now. It's at M Finney Golf, Finney Golf, M Finney Golf. And that's where I do do some small videos from time to time. That's where I would post them. I have some videos on Vimeo that they could look up and see some stuff. I did a really fun kinetics thing, which was the forces and torques of the golf swing, with Sasho and Joe Mayo and Chris Como a few years back at ULGC. That was, gosh, it's a long time. 2017, we did that. And that's on Vimeo also. And that's like a for sale video, but it's worth it. It's several hours of content. And then I've done some Zoom calls like this with some researchers, so a lot of the ping guys that you mentioned, plus a handful of other guys. And really over the pandemic, we did some of those things, and I put those up on Vimeo also. And I think you need to donate $25 to Golf Science, the Golf Science website, which runs the World Scientific Congress of Golf. $25, so they get all of that money. But you have access to some of those Zoom calls I did with some of these researchers. So if you really want to get really deep into it, those would be good avenues. And if you just want a golf lesson, you can contact me. It's 502-314-GOLF 4653. 502-314-GOLF. And that's how I book my lessons. Just text or call me there, and we can get you out to Simpsonville, Kentucky, and hit some golf balls.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you joining us. Be sure to check out Mike on social media. Be sure to book a lesson if you're in the area. And then if you're trying to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at the Tournament Code and on Twitter /X Tournament Code. If you see us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube, if you made it this far, make sure to like and subscribe. That helps us. As always, we appreciate you joining us. Look forward to diving in deeper to what it takes to play elite tournament golf.